Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast, brought to you by Athletes on the Rise. Nowadays, athletes need to develop in multiple ways to obtain college scholarships and professional contracts. Athletes on the Rise will do just that. AOTR uses multidisciplinary sports science knowledge to develop complete athletes mentally, physically, technically, and tactically. We go above and beyond what is expected to give athletes a training experience that is tailored to the individual. We constantly push our athletes outside their comfort zones, and we make sure that athletes are doing the right things in the right way to maximize their development. Athletes on the Rise, training redefined. Follow us online, ask us questions, read our content. Our website is http://aotr.training. Find us on Instagram at aotr.training, Twitter at aotr_training, and facebook.com/AOTR.training. Before we get to today's podcast, I just want to remind all the listeners that we will be having a couple of great guests coming up here over the next week. The first will be Isaac Mourier of Impact Basketball out in Las Vegas, formerly of the University of Georgia. He was formerly a sports nutritionist out there. Currently at Impact Basketball, he modifies dietary plans, creates dietary plans for NBA players and NBA draft entrants. And basically, we'll be going through the basic tenets of nutrition in addition to how to build up a proper dietary plan as an athlete and how to go about making some behavior changes in order to make sure you make changes that will last. From there, we will be having Coach Heather Stewart, who you can term as a culture expert, so to speak. She is a phenomenal coach that has done work with USA Basketball and the Golden State Warriors. And she continues to kind of inspire cultural change around here. She will continually go into various sports settings, basketball specific, whether that be at the high school or collegiate level. And she'll take losing programs that have barely won any games to championship type contenders. So that will be on later in the week. If you have any need to change culture, improve the culture in the organization you are with, from the ground up, whether that be with the parents that are involved, with the players, and with the organization, then this will be a phenomenal podcast for you. We have another great podcast for you today. Today, our guest is Brandon Linton. Brandon Linton has just moved on from West Point to go coach at Nichols College. West Point is a breeding ground for leadership. They have had some great coaches that have come out of there, most notably Coach K and Bobby Knight. So he's got some great stories to share and some great insights on how they develop a culture of leadership and servitude, hard work, grit, resilience. In addition to that, we're going to be comparing Division I and Division III players, in addition to the differences between Division I and Division III coaching responsibilities, how they go about recruiting, and the interview process for different schools, again, between Division I and Division III, whether that be a head coach or an assistant coach. So again, there is a great deal of knowledge to be shared here today. There's going to be a lot of learning. So make sure you have that attention to detail, turn your brains on, and get started. Eric here on the Rise Up Podcast with my friend and coach, Brandon Linton. How you doing, Brandon?
I'm great, man. It's great, getting to talk to you again, man. All's well on this side.
Awesome, awesome. We're going to jump right into it. So right now you are a coach where? What's the name of the university you're at right now?
Yes, I'm a head coach at Nicholls College in Dudley, Massachusetts.
Okay, Nicholls College in Massachusetts. But you've had quite the journey to get there. And one of the things that we're going to be speaking about mostly today is kind of your experiences over at West Point, which is obviously a Division I school, but a very high level school when it comes to, you know, leadership and service development. But before we jump into those things, I just wanted to know, why you got into coaching.
Yeah, it was funny, and it's something that's probably always been in the cards for me. Obviously, mm-hmm. probably similar to you. Mm-hmm. basketball was kind of always my life. You know, I played it from an early age. Everything I consumed on TV was, basketball related. Mm-hmm. Anytime I had free time, it was usually devoted to doing something within the game. So just naturally, going mm-hmm. and getting to college, and obviously we were teammates at Clarkson. But being right. there, I would even say to myself sometimes, and mostly to Keith Murray, who you probably remember.
I know. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Keith was obviously my roommate in same year as me at Clarkson, but I would tell him all the time, like, "Hey man, I think I want to like coach when this is all done," and he wouldn't take me serious because most of the stuff I said back then, he couldn't take it serious. But it was funny. It was actually our head coach, Coach Stockwell, was probably the first one who really saw it in me, which almost mm-hmm. kind of made it feel real. Obviously I respected right. Coach Stockwell. He recruited me to Clarkson. But he said, in his office, he was just like, what do you want to do after, your 4 years are up? And, I told him, I was thinking about, maybe going into business or whatever, following my degree. And he was like, "You're going to hate it." After 2 or 3 years, he told me straight up, he's like, "You're going to hate it." He's like, I was the same way. You belong in basketball for the rest of your life. And that kind of just stuck with me. And I don't know if it was premonition or prophecy or what, but, kind of spoke it into existence. But I always thought I would end up where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah. So you started out coaching at Clarkson, right? So you started out coaching at the Division III level, and you, what after that was like Bowdoin and then on to West Point. Did I get that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Am I right?
Yep. Yeah, so you even got the pronunciation correct with Bowdoin. Good job. Ooh,
that's, you like that, right? No, I had a friend that played at Colby, so he talked about it all the time. He is an Irishman by the name of Michael Westbrooks. Okay. But yeah, I would say the typical Bowdoin.
Yep.
Whatever. It's like now it's Bowdoin, man. Bowdoin.
Yeah. We'll probably touch on this in the recruiting part, but everywhere I've been, it's always like, "Wait a second, what's your school?" So that was
right.
Well, good job by you, man. Yeah. So that was the path.
Yeah. So talk about that. What was your initial responsibilities at Clarkson and how did they expand at Bowdoin? And then we'll start there and then we'll eventually talk about the move to West Point.
Yeah. So it's funny. And I guess it kind of ties back into, the first question about, how did I get into coaching? When I got to Clarkson, mm-hmm. When I came back to Clarkson to coach, that wasn't initially the plan. I actually had a job lined up with Wells Fargo Bank coming out of Clarkson. So, kudos to CU. They came true on everything that they said. I had a job lined up, it was supposed to start July 2010. But that was right during the whole economic, downturn. So I actually got my job offer revoked, a week before I was supposed to start. After that happened, was kind of back to the drawing board, had a bunch of different options and, business and, different basketball things. But, eventually I got led back to Clarkson because the mm-hmm. coach there, they said they had an opening in admissions, that could be my full-time job. And, I could come back and help out with the basketball team in a volunteer capacity. So when I got back to CU, I was more so there, my full-time job was working in admissions. And I was just coming when I can to practices, obviously going to all the games, helping out recruiting where I can. Mm-hmm. But my main responsibility initially was undergraduate and transfer admissions, which in a funny way has kind of set me up, you know, most for where I'm at now. You know, just learning that mm-hmm. side of the house in terms of, you know, what it takes to, you know, go through the admissions process and, you know, the recruiting that honestly goes into that aspect as well. That was some of the stuff I leaned on and I still lean on to this day, was kind of some of the stuff I learned in the admissions room.
Yeah, and that's stuff that you don't really normally think of as a coach of like, I have to understand transfer and admissions. You know, you're thinking the X and O's and player development and so on and so forth. But to understand the behind the scenes stuff a little bit more helps you. Yeah, I would imagine that would help you in a big way.
And it's funny, it really, you know, it's kind of helped me even more now as a D3 head coach as opposed to a Division I assistant. You know, as a D3 head coach, mm-hmm. you wear a lot more hats, and a lot of the times it's, you know, you're almost dueling as a admissions counselor, you know what I mean? Because you got to deal with transcripts and, you know, loans and that whole process and FAFSA and yada, yada, yada. So it's funny how everything's kind of come full circle. But, you know, it was, you know, after doing that for 2 years at Clarkson and doing the volunteer basketball stuff, you know, I realized after 2 years I was having way more fun, you know, doing what I wasn't getting paid to do, which was coaching, than I was, you know, doing the admissions work. And just like Stockwell said, mm-hmm. you know, he was like, listen, you're going to get wrapped up into this because you love it too much. So that's what happened. After those 2 years, I started, you know, looking around for full-time, you know, coaching opportunities. And luckily, Mark Gilbride, you know, he took over after Stockwell. That's who I, you know, ended up working for as a volunteer assistant. His dad was a head coach at Bowdoin. So when his dad had an opening, you know, he said, hey, I think you'd be great for that. You should try and get it. And that's kind of what led me, led me that direction.
Okay. All right. And then, so you got on over to Bowdoin, and you were an assistant under his dad. What was his dad's name? What was the coach's name?
Tim Gilbride.
So you were assistant under him. You went over there, and for Division III basketball, that's some of the best in the nation, that NESCAC conference at that time. So you transferred from, you know, from one place to another, started coaching at over there. But then how did the responsibilities shift? What was the next things that you had to learn at that stage?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, It was great in a number of different ways. Obviously, like you touched on, you know, the basketball piece was huge. You know, we were fortunate to play at Clarkson and have, you know, great success. But I always like to equate, you know, Clarkson to being like a high level, you know, mid major D3. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where you know those NESCACs are almost like your high majors. So it was just it opened the door to just almost a higher level than I was used to seeing. Mm-hmm. But you know, as the lead assistant, I had, you know, everything on my plate. You know, I was fortunate that Coach Gilbride, he made it that way. You know, he told me, you know, straight up when I was interviewing for the job, he goes, listen, I'm going to throw a lot at you. And, you know, if you're good at what you do, you know, you'll be out of here in 2 to 3 years. And if you're not, I'm going to have to find somebody who is. So I had, you know, everything on my plate from, you know, obviously, you know, recruiting was a big part of it, you know, being the equipment guy to being, you know, the newsletter, the Photoshop guy. Like I had responsibility outside of actually, you know, being the head coach. I had the opportunity to kind of do, which was great for my learning curve, and it just exposed me to so much, you know, versus when I was at Clarkson, it was almost like being the older brother, you know what I mean? I had just trained with a lot of those guys, you know, I could kind of chime in here and there, but there wasn't the major responsibility to deliver on everything, you know, because there was a head coach and the head assistant coach for that. You know, I kind of just added my 2 cents where necessary. Versus, you know, when you get to Bowdoin, now all that stuff carries way more weight, and it matters that you come through on what you're doing.
Right. So, all right. So you had all that responsibility, and then it sounds like you guys did well there. You know, and then 2 to 3 years, you got out, and all of a sudden an opportunity came up over at West Point, and I mean, talk about how that opportunity came up and how are you able to take advantage of it and be able to obtain that position.
Yeah, so that's an extra, you know, added benefit of being at a place like Bowdoin. You know, a big a big thing when you're at those places is, you know, obviously recruiting and going to all different camps. So each of, you know, my spring and summers out of season, you know, I spent traveling around to the different Ivy League and Patriot League, you know, elite camps that they would host. And you know, having the little polo or t-shirt on that said Bowden, you know, almost gave you a little bit more credibility. So that helped with networking and, you know, just making connections. So, you know, after my second year at Bowdoin, I actually had a couple different opportunities that came my way. The first one was Aaron Kelly at Bucknell. He was an assistant there, and he used to he was our yeah your senior year at Clarkson, he was our assistant coach.
Assistant
Um,
coach.
but he was you know, the first one that was like, hey, you know, Coach Paulson, who was the head coach at Bucknell at the time, he was like, hey, we have an opening for an assistant, would love for you to you know, interview for it. So that was the kind of first D1 opportunity that I had. Went through that interview process, was terrible, didn't get it, or terrible, you know, I'm probably being harsh on myself, but you know, went through it.
Why do you think it was terrible? Why do you think it was terrible?
That was just the first time I had a crack at a Division One opportunity, you know, and I probably was a little too anxious, or you know, who knows, maybe you know, the other person just was a way better candidate, you know, I'm probably again being too hard on myself, but it ended up not going my way. Then, you know, after that, like a week or two after that, the Yale head coach had reached out to me, because that was another one of the camps that I worked a lot, and I developed a great relationship with him. And you know, he interviewed me for an opening. Again, didn't end up getting that one. But then both of those guys were pretty close to the Army head coach. So when they had an opening, you know, they recommended me as somebody to at least reach out to and check out. Then I guess third time was a charm, and I didn't stumble over myself as much. And you know, Coach Spiker made the decision to go my way.
So what do you feel that you got better at between the different interviews? What are some things that stick out that you mentally, you know, after you I'm sure you did some reflections after the interview and say, you know, I thought I answered this well. You know, maybe I didn't answer this as well. What did you consciously do to get better at those interviews?
That's a great question. I'm not sure, and even early on back then, you know, I'm not sure I did anything super consciously, you know what I mean? It was more of just a rhythm and a feel of, all right, you've done this before, you know what I mean? Like just kind of be yourself, which seems simple, but was kind of what just happened, I think. And with anything, the more you do it, the more confidence you get in it. I think it was, you know, as I started moving on, you know, and getting to Army, I had a couple chances to interview for head coaching positions, and those are a lot more intensive than, you know, just an assistant coach, you know, phone interview. You know what I mean? So, I would say those, you know, each one I had, there was more introspection and reflection on, all right, this went well, this didn't go well, this is, you know, what you should do. But, you know, back then it was more just like, all right, like, just have a conversation, like, be yourself, like, you know, if they want you. You know, when someone's hiring for an assistant position, it's either they want you or not. You're not necessarily auditioning as much. So, you know, once I did that and, you know, just kind of, you know, let the chips fall where they may, I felt like I was more comfortable in those interviews.
Were they pretty similar as far as format, as far as when you came in and they interviewed you for the assistants, for the assistant jobs? You know, it was a pretty similar line of questioning, or were there some differences?
Each place was different. It depended on, like, for example, when I was doing the Bucknell one, that was just a phone call with the head coach. So it didn't go beyond that. When it was Yale, I had more familiarity with the head coach. So I essentially was expedited to the on-campus part, where we walked around, did a whole bunch of things, had an itinerary laid out. And it was more of just kind of hanging out that day and, you know, just kind of living a day in the life almost. And then when I got to to Army was almost a combination of both. You know, I wasn't as familiar with the head coach. Okay. So, you know, we talked on the phone, you know, I talked to the other assistant coaches, then, you know, made it onto campus and did that whole deal. So it was almost like a combination of both the Bucknell phone interview and the Yale on campus. So it was a nice kind of, you know, lead up, you know. Maybe if I would have just jumped right into that, you know, Army interview, I might not have been as comfortable and done as well, or who knows. But it's funny, you know, Spiker, who ended up hiring me, always jokes around and goes, well, B, you know, the other five guys turned it down, so you are our last option. So, as well.
Yeah. So along those lines a little bit, you know, what were, before we jump into the West Point stuff a little bit more into detail, you know, what was some of the lines of question? What did they want to know about you to better get to know you and whether or not you'd be the right fit?
At Army?
In general, at the, you know, whether it be the coaching conversations with at Bucknell or the on-campus tours over at Yale, and then obviously over at Army as well. But I mean, what were the things that they're trying to find out to figure out whether or not you'd be a right fit for who they are?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think it was two different areas, obviously basketball-wise. One, just hearing, you know, all right, what did you guys do at Bowdoin? You know, what'd you do at Clarkson? You know, just trying to get a feel for, you know, the basketball knowledge. As a person, you know, really the on-campus, I don't think it was necessarily a line of questioning, more so than, all right, let's see how this guy interacts in our space. You know, is this our kind of guy? So I can't, yeah. I don't think I could pinpoint, like, you know, specific questions, nor, you know, being on the other side of it now, I don't think that there's no question that anyone's going to ask that's going to say, yep, this is, you know, this is going to fit.
Right.
It's more of, all right, does this, and this is how I felt going through it, but does he align with right. what we're trying to do here? And that, you know, that's not a right or wrong answer. That's just more of a feel and kind of, you know, as you go through and as you kind of do things and what you talk about and what you emphasize and, you know, where you vibe on certain things, I think that's, you know, how you get those answers.
Got it. No, I mean, those are some actually pretty key insights as well, because, you know, like I said, this is more than anything else, this is an educational podcast, not just for athletes and parents and coaches as well. And, you know, I'm hoping to reach some coaches that are trying to get in the foot in the door at some point where they can just kind of mentally start to understand some of those details as far as, oh, well, yeah, obviously you want to look for programs that are willing to take you on board, but, you know, you want to find those programs that I think, you know, align with what you believe in as well. You don't want to go to certain universities that have viewpoints in X, Y, and Z, but you're on the complete other end of the spectrum.
And that's a great point, Eric. You know, it's not like, you know, it's funny, you do have to align yourself as well for the opportunities you're going for. You know, if I would have tried to, you know, go to, you know, like, for example, like I interviewed with three places that were reputable academically, you know what I mean? Luckily, you know, I went to Clarkson, that has a good reputation on the academic side. I was at Bowdoin, you know, for 2.5 years, which is considered one of the best colleges in America. So, like, that made sense for me to be going for those opportunities. You know, I won't name, you know, a different type of school or whatever, but, you know, you could just imagine, like, if I tried to go for a profile of a school that didn't align with that, that it wouldn't make sense.
Right.
You know, so I think initially, and especially for, you know, maybe people, you know, trying to navigate that process, you need to make sure you're going for things that make sense to, you know, to you and what you've done. And thinking that way, you need to go after opportunities that, you know, kind of fit, you know, what you want your path to be. You know, that was one thing that I heard early on, I think at a Final Four, but it was just like, all right, you know, who are you trying to be? Where do you want to end up? You know, and make sure you're going after opportunities that fall along that path. You know, I knew once I, you know, started at the Clarkson Bowdoin and ended up at Army, like, I wasn't going to go to, you know, random JUCO. Like, that's kind of outside of, you know, what my, you know, resume and path is kind of building to be.
Right. And you also mentioned a couple other details that have been kind of harped on by a lot of other coaches and people that have been giving advice to coaches as well, as far as getting the foot in the door, one of the best places to start is just kind of getting into some of those camps, and then creating those relationships and maintaining those relationships. I mean, it's almost like a business in a way as well. You want to create that funnel. You want to create a good reputation. You want to have a lot of options. And then as you kind of are determining who you are and your identity, you know, starting to zero in on, okay, I think, you know, this path is, this is more towards the one for me. And you develop those relationships a little bit more, and, you know, whether they're going to take you on board, mentor you, or point you in the right direction. I mean, those are some key points to help coaches get going.
Oh, it's huge. I would almost venture to say it's everything. You know, it's funny thinking back on the connections I made, you know, at those camps, either people that were in my same boat that were peers at the time working the camp, you know, those are, you know, some of my mm-hmm. best coaching friends now and helped me, you right. know, get to, you know, certain opportunities that I have versus, you know, right. guys that were on the staffs of those colleges that, you know, we're working the camps for. Like, it's just, that's my number one piece of advice to any, you know, any young coach that's trying to get in. It's just like, listen, work as many camps as you can. Like, I was lucky at Army, I was in charge of our camps. So, like, I ran nice. Them, you know, I had to hire for them, and, you know, that was the best thing I think that, you know, led to, you know, me getting a head coaching job, and, you know, all the experiences I kind of lean off of, a lot of them I kind of learned mm-hmm. running the camps, you know, learning right. how to hire, you know, you're essentially running a program, you know what I mean? So, you know, one of the things that was awesome was all the different, you know, young coaches that I got to meet, you know, through our camps over the years that now are off doing all kinds of different stuff. So, right. It's just a great, great breeding ground to, you know, foster connections and networks and, you know, keep your path going in the profession.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to segue now more into, you know, West Point and, kind of your experiences there. So we talked about how you went through the interview process and you obtained the job there. Coming on board, you know, what were those responsibilities like in comparison to Bowden before that?
Yeah. So, you know, simply at Bowden, everything was like, I had a hat for a lot of different things. You know what I mean? And it wasn't as focused as it was when you get to Army. You know, I was the only assistant coach, and we had another volunteer guy at Bowden. At Army, I was one of four assistant coaches plus the head coach, you know, mm-hmm. plus we had an operations person. So there was more of a direct, hey, B, you're responsible for X, Y, and Z, which was neat because it allowed you to focus in on things right. more and be more detailed and more, you know, focused on mm-hmm. specific areas versus just making sure you kind of do a bunch of things well. So early on, right. like one of the things obviously that we just spoke about was camps, but, you know, I was able to, you know, be in charge of the equipment, things outside of basketball were like camp equipment, and things of that nature. On the court was, you know, working with our wing players, and making sure that they're developing, recruiting wise, right. Early on, I was more in charge of underclass recruiting, and making sure that we had an eye on the next crop of guys coming up. Then as I was there for a while, it shifted into, you know, Northeast recruiting. Then eventually it shifted into, you know, recruiting the South. So, you know, it was a different experience as an assistant at the D1 level versus the D3, because you might have fewer responsibilities overall, but you are way more in depth and detailed into what you were expected to do.
Okay, so you're saying, speak to how the recruiting responsibilities changed over those 3 years a little bit more then.
Yeah. So my first year and a half, I was a new young guy on staff, and we had an associate head coach who was more of a veteran guy. So I was almost like his assistant, so to speak. So the underclass recruiting that I would do, he would be like, for example, say, you know, back in 2015, he'd be recruiting the guys that were going to be, you know, coming up that fall. I would be focused on the guys that were juniors and sophomores in high school. and making sure that those, those crop of guys were coming up next down the pipeline.
Gotcha. Okay.
As I got a little bit more, veteran on staff and experience, then I got my own recruiting territory. So initially, like I said, it was the Northeast because I had spent time, at Bowdoin and at Clarkson a little bit via divisions, working in the Northeast. Then, around year three or so, I got a bigger territory recruiting the South. And the South is where we get probably a lot more, kids at West Point versus the Northeast.
Okay.
So it was almost an elevation in the sense of, all right, now I'm dealing in an area where, there's more receptive ears and, more guys to potentially go after. So it kind of just mushroomed as I was there.
Okay. So how did you then find the recruits that fit your program? What did you do?
Yeah, it takes a lot of, it's cool being at a place like West Point, because you get, you get exposed to the whole nation as your recruiting area. And that's what was nice about having, four assistant coaches. Most Division I schools, all Division I schools except for service academies, have three assistant coaches. Service academies have four. So with that, we were able to break up the country into pockets and really hone in on, tackling the country. Because obviously being at a place like West Point, recruiting is just the lifeblood of, what we do. So, we got to make sure we're finding guys and, finding different guys that people don't know about. So it was a lot of time on the phone, leaning on, recruiting services and, AAU and high school coaches in the area, just to generate as many names as possible. Then it also helps too being at a place that's, academically reputable, because it wasn't just like we're recruiting everybody, it was, all right, one, do they have the grades? Perfect. Boom. All right. Two, do they have
first funnel?
Yeah, exactly. After that, all right, are they the original one basketball player? All right, boom. Now, when you're dealing with that crop of guys, now you could sift through, all right, which guys want to do something extraordinary? There's a lot of guys that have great grades and could potentially play at the Division II, Division I level. But which guys want to separate themselves from the pack? So a lot of times on those phone calls, that's what you were trying to figure out. And then obviously, once you thought you had a group of guys that, were worth checking out, you hit the recruiting trail. All right, let's go see this guy in an open gym. Let's go watch this guy, play AAU. All right, we love this guy. Let's make sure we're going, in September to check out his practices. All right, let's try and catch a game if we can, if we're in that area. So it all depends, but the biggest thing that, it starts with is just on that phone and finding guys that, want to be a little different, want to be a little unique, and get on after it that way.
So what would stick out to you during those conversations that would make you think, this kid is different?
Yeah. It's funny. We always say it, like, there's not one kid that ever wakes up and says, hey, I want to go to West Point and play basketball. Every guy on our roster would tell you the same thing like that. They never thought that was on the cards. But it might not be necessarily one thing that you say, yep, that kid's, that's our guy. But it's a number of different things. You know what I mean? Like, all right, does this kid, is he talking about, ball is life? Like, I just want to go somewhere and go play pro after, and I want to go to the best place that's going to do that for me. All right, if he says that, then, he's probably not going to be, committed to, going to Army and being in the Army for 5 years after graduation. You know what I mean? Guys are talking about, I want to set myself up for my future, the next 40 years of my life, if they're having that type of perspective, then it's like, all right, this kid might be somebody that's worth talking to. Right. It's a little bigger than just basketball for them. Like, they want to obviously succeed on the court, but they're thinking outside of that. They understand that the ball, stops bouncing. If you have a kid that, thinks that way, boom, now you could really, get to work trying to recruit that guy. Because, the biggest thing, I learned at West Point was, just the education piece of recruiting. You know what I mean? Like, And honestly, that's one of the common threads throughout all the stops I've made is, you know, even Clarkson being in admissions, you know, the first thing is just, you know, my territory was New York City and Long Island. So the first thing would be like,
right.
Where the heck is Clarkson? You know, so, you know, you couldn't just pick up the phone. You know, the thing is, you couldn't just pick up the phone and be like, this is Clarkson, come to it because it's awesome and you know about it. No, you have to like break down, all right, what is Clarkson? Why is it important? Why is it good? The same thing was true at Bowdoin. You know, people pick up the phone and be like, Bowdoin, you know, what's that? You know, you would have to, you know, educate people on what it is that you were talking about. Same deal when I went to Army. You know, if you pick up the phone and say, this is Coach Brandon from Army, you know, more times than not, you're probably going to have somebody hang the phone up on you. And, you know, so I was never at a place where it was like, hey, this is Coach Brandon at Duke. All right, perfect. Let's, you know, you're interested.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So,
right.
You know, there was I had to learn the part about, you know, just that education selling on what it is that we had. And once we, you know, once you found a kid that, you know, was thinking about more than just basketball, West Point became easy to sell. You know, it's a place that will, you know, would set you up for your future, you know, financially separate you from your peers, you know, eliminate those sometimes invisible glass ceilings that, you know, exist in other places. You know, it's really a fast track to, you know, financial freedom and, you know, just a great future for yourself. And once you started to kind of frame their minds around that, you know, they got more and more interested to the point where it's like, you know, a lot of these kids were, you know, almost recruiting themselves to West Point versus us trying to bring them to come once they realized the benefits of it. So, the process was a lot longer and a lot more difficult than probably most normal places or most non-academies, but it made it a lot more rewarding for sure.
Okay, so I'm gonna touch into some of the subjects you're talking about. You said obviously they had to have the education, but they were also, you know, a Division I basketball player. What do you see that sticks out that makes a player a Division I basketball player?
That's a good question, man. Like, it depends too. Like, we're a different Division I than Kentucky.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
right.
At Army, you know, we had to, you know, our prism was different than even Bucknell in our league. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, we had to look for guys that had as many, you know, traits as possible that led to a successful Division I player. You know, a lot of times too, where we would have success is recruiting guys that had a lot of Division II options. You know, for us, it was kind of identifying those guys and trying to position ourselves as, you know, the best overall option for them. But obviously, you know, there's different things that, you know, lead to a Division I player. You know, for some guys, it's the athleticism piece. You know, they have all the measurables and, you know, this guy is, you know, he has the length, he has the, you know, the jumping ability, the speed. For other guys, they're exceptional at, you know, maybe one thing, maybe it's a shooting piece. You know, you combine that with, hey, this guy's got size and he shoots it at a high clip, but he doesn't necessarily have the athleticism. All right, you know, we could work with that. Or, you know, vice versa.
Yeah.
This guy has the measurables and the athleticism, but doesn't have that shooting piece. All right, we could work with that. So it was a lot of,
right.
You know, obviously if you could find that guy that has it all, all right, you either got to steal or every guy in your league is recruiting them and they're probably going to have a chance at them over you because, you know, they don't have 5 years of military service waiting for them. So for us at Army, you know, identifying who could be successful Division I players was a little different for us. You know, there was a lot more, you know, kind of not wait and see, but all right, this guy might have the potential to be, or this guy definitely is and nobody knows about him. Or, you know, this guy's definitely a Division I player, but other Division I's are shying away because he doesn't have the size that, quote unquote, Division I players should have. But, you know, that's kind of some of the stuff that went into it on our side of, you know, recruiting.
So how does that differ from Division III then? How are things different from, you know, from a skill, size, athleticism point of view? Obviously, I mean, from point blank, you could obviously see it on TV, but just verbalize it in a way that is kind of understandable that creates those differences between kind of Division I, II, and III from your perspective.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of times, too, it's funny how academics a lot of times will change that equation for you. Like, there's guys that are playing Division III that easily could be at a scholarship level place, but they just didn't have the, you know, the academics to make it into some of these places. So they fall to the D3 level. Or, you know, there are guys that have that Division I ability that, for whatever reason, they didn't get the proper exposure. So, you know, you're able to find, you know, kind of those steals. But probably the greater majority of Division III recruiting is, all right, like we just talked about, you know, they didn't, you know, a lot of the D1s and scholarships, they look for, you know, you to be exceptional in a number of different areas. And they might misjudge that, or, you know, that might actually be the case. But all of a sudden now, you know, you have this 6'4 dead eye shooter that is landing at your D3 school because the D1s thought, well, he's 6'4 and could shoot, but he's not athletic enough to guard at our level. So, you know, that's how you're almost, you know, you're almost essentially doing what we're doing at Army, you know. You know, waiting for those higher level D1s to pass up on a guy, or, you know, swooping in and stealing the guy that the high level D2s are after, but, you know, we could get him because we're Division I. You know, you're almost doing that at the D3 level where you're like, all right, let's see where, you know, where's the market at with this guy? Like, all right, are D2s checking in on him? And, you know, they're just afraid to pull the trigger because, you know, he doesn't have X, Y, or Z. All right, let's stay on that guy. Like, that might be a guy that we get. That might be a little higher level of a player that, you know, we could get at our level because D2s pass on them, you know what I mean? Or it's, hey, right, no one's really recruiting this kid because they think X, Y, and Z, but look what he can do. You know, he could really shoot it. Like, if you put him in, you know, in our system, yada, yada. So that's, you know, it's kind of the same, but just on a different scale. You know, but the general, I think the general blank would be, yeah, obviously, I think at the D3 level, there's a regression in, you know, the size, speed, and athleticism from a general standpoint. But, you know, you could find a number of different individual circumstances where, you know, there's D1 guys. Yeah, there are D1 guys all in Division III. It just happened that for whatever that, you know, individual circumstance was, he didn't end up landing at that level.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that is interesting to hear how some of those people do kind of slip through the cracks, so to speak, and how, you know, those just those small differences as well. Like, you see the different consistencies, but yeah, this kid doesn't have the athleticism, or this kid might have some athleticism, but not quite as much as a Division I, and his skill level isn't there. So, I mean, to be able to judge between those different levels, and it's also interesting to hear, you know, players' perspective or parents' perspective as well, because a lot of them think, you know, I'm a Division I player, where it's, you know, it's you know, you're not, you know, that's the other perspective as well. And then, you know, sometimes some of those kids, and you might have had experience as well, they just, you know, they cut off some of those connections early on, and then all of a sudden they don't have any options to go play later on. So, I mean, I think it's usually a better option to just at least, you know, be cordial, have those conversations, but don't treat yourself.
And that's the biggest thing too, right? That I think the tough part, you know, for, you know, parents and, you know, kids, is what gets glorified is, you know, the one ESPN story about, you know, the kid that didn't have any scholarship offers and ended up at X university, and now he's playing a March Madness, you know, and that's so few and far between, that almost becomes, you know, everyone thinks that they could be that person or that next story. So that's tough, and I get that. But the biggest thing, you know, I would say or caution, you know, parents is, you know, give a fair shake to, you know, these D3s and D2s, because you'd be surprised, you know, the level of basketball obviously that's played, but the amount of opportunities that could come if you go that route, you know, you could end up having more, you know, more ahead of you by playing at a D2 or D3 versus, you know, going to a D1 where you might play or you might ride the bench the whole time. So, you know, it's tough. It's not easy. And, you know, I don't want to be that guy that's like, you know, trying to tell people like, you know, no.
You're not this player. Yeah, exactly. Go for it. Yeah.
Well, it's tough. And it's a fine line and all that stuff. But the biggest thing is, you know, go where you're wanted at the end of the day. Because, you know, that's the number one thing that, you know, I always tell guys, because you'll see, and you know it, obviously you've been in basketball, but a lot of times in a recruiting process, you know, there's a lot of games that are played on both sides. And, you know, I always, you know, one thing I heard that I love using now is, you know, how you're treated in the recruiting process is, you know, a glimpse into how you're going to be treated, you know, for the 4 years that you're at that institution. So you'll know right away, you know, whether or not, you know, a place really wants you, really values you. A lot of times it's better to bet on that than to, you know, try and, you know, convince
right.
ex-coach somewhere otherwise and, you know, spend your whole time, you know, trying to get the affection of somebody that probably doesn't really value you at the end of the day.
Right, right. Okay, so moving on a little bit to some of the other, like, recruiting pieces. When you're looking at, again, at West Point from like a character or personality point of view, you know, what were some of the things that would stick out to make you think like, yeah, this is, you know, this is a kid that we want from that perspective?
Yeah. Obviously, you know, I think it'd be easier to know what you don't want. You know what I mean? You know, guys that obviously, you know, talk back, you know, people that aren't viewed as coachable, you know, those guys, you know, for the most part, probably aren't going to cut it, you know, when they show up to basic training and they have, you know, some military guy yelling in their face, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, it's
yeah. Not at all.
Exactly. But obviously, all the traits that you would find in anybody that's successful are the same people that you would, you know, hopefully recruit to West Point. You know, people that are respectable, people that are courteous of others, people that have an understanding that, you know, it's not just about them. You know, those are things that, you know, if you come in, you know, thinking otherwise, you know, you're going to struggle big time at West Point. But if you're one of those guys, and you know, it's pretty easy, honestly, like, you know, the guys that are typically, you know, honor this or, you know, captain of this or involved in multiple sports, you know, those guys,
yep.
You know, they're involved in their community. Like those, there's no magic dust, you know, the, you know,
yeah.
The one thing that we always would say at West Point is like, there's no, the guys on our team are no different than, you know, kids that you know or kids that you grew up with. Like these are all good kids, you know. That's probably the most general way of saying it. Like good kids are, you know, who stand out. Guys that are headaches, guys that are pain in the butts, guys that don't get, you know, as great reviews. Like it's pretty simple that you're probably, you know, not going to cut it at, you know, the premier leadership institution in the world. Right. You know, me and you, you know, Eric, we, you know, we would be guys that would be great candidates at West Point. You know, you more yeah. than me for sure. But, you know, just,
I don't know about that. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. But the point being is like, there's not, you know, these guys aren't superheroes, but you know, what it is,
yeah.
you know, they're good people that want to do something special and want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. That's the starting point, you know, and then West Point, you know, does what they do throughout that 4-year experience to mold these guys into the leaders that they're going to be. But none of them come in as what they finish as, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no. And you're leading right into what I wanted to get into next, you know? So what made West Point the premier leadership school, not just in the States, but probably in the world?
Yeah, honestly, a number of things, the totality of, you know, the 46 month experience that they, you know, that's what we refer to it as, you know, from day one, you know, the first thing you do when you get to West Point for all incoming cadets is, you know, that basic training piece. So you go through 6 weeks of basic training and, you know, it kind of sounds daunting and scary and all that stuff, you know, beforehand. But, you know, what cadets probably don't realize in that moment. But when you take a step back and you kind of analyze it from, you know, the bigger perspective, what makes West Point great is that it breaks everybody down to be at the same level. So it doesn't matter if you came in as valedictorian of your high school or you came in and, you know, you were, you know, 100th in your class. You know, everyone is made to be the same from day one. And throughout the course of basic training, you know, you're kind of made to essentially realize that, you know, it's bigger than just you. So right off the bat, like you get you get the best foundation that you can as a person, you know, let alone a student or a cadet or whatever. Like, you get an appreciation for, you know, others around you, working within a group to, you know, achieve something. So that's like the first thing you do in your first 6 weeks. And that, yep. I feel, at least, you know, kind of seeing it, that's what embodied the, you know, the experience of being at a place like West Point. You just get that appreciation of group over self. And that's what makes, you know, that's what makes them great leaders. You know, the other part that, you know, made West Point special is, you know, during those, and it's funny, there's a lot of misconceptions too. Like, they think, you know, the whole time guys are, you know, running around from, you know, August to May with rifles over their heads and bear crawling in between classes. Like, that couldn't be further. Yeah, that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you get, okay, you know, you get the basic training the 6 weeks leading up to school starting in the fall. But then once school starts, you know, from August to May, it's school. You know, you're just wearing a uniform the whole time. But you're going to class, you know, you're playing sports if you're on a team, obviously. You know, you're being a college kid. But the summers is where some of that kind of magic happens. Cause that's when, you know, your military training takes place. And it's not the entire summer, but it's like, you know, weeks at a time, you know, anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to, you know, 5 to 6 weeks, depending on where you're at in your summer training or in your time at West Point. But that's really where I think, you know, the foundation of being a great leader, you know, comes into play. Like I said, your first summer is that basic training before you even start West Point. You know, your next summer, as a, you know, after your freshman year is done, you're doing a lot of stuff where you're learning, you know, how to kind of follow, you know, basic training. All you're doing is following. You're getting barked at, you know, they're breaking you down. You're learning, you're really being a follower. Your freshman year, you're still doing some of that following stuff. But they're given, chances for you to, you know, do things in a leadership capacity. You know, your sophomore year, and it elevates, you know, from the time, you know, your sophomore, you're doing more of the same. Your junior year, you're getting a chance to, you know, lead the freshman. You know what I mean? So now as a junior, you might be the guy, you know, yelling at the plebes during basic training. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're going from learning, because essentially now you've been in their shoes. You know what it's like. And now you're getting your hand at, you know, kind of leadership. You know, senior year, you might go out to, you know, the Army's version or West Point's version of career, you know, internships. You know, you'll actually go out to a military base and shadow, you know, what they're doing. So throughout these summers, they, you know, they take you through that transformative period of learning how to follow, all right, learning how to lead, and now learning how to, you know, kind of see it hands on. And by the time you graduate, you know, you've gotten all these experiences that, you look back and you say, wow, you know, that, you know, I'm way different and way better of a leader, you know, 4 years removed from when I was coming out of my high school in Indiana, you know what I mean? So it's really the totality of the place. But the biggest thing is just, you know, just that, that framing of, you know, group over self. And then the other big thing that I would add to that is the structure piece. You know, it's, you know, obviously your time is managed and everything is kind of, you know, lock and step and whatnot. But, you know, what I learned and what I kind of have taken from it is, you know, that structure creates freedom. You know what I mean? Structure allows you to have a clear vision of what needs to get accomplished and when, and allows you to be more direct in your approach and allows you to get stuff done, honestly. So that's, I think, you know, one of the other secrets to, you know, success.
Right. So I want to touch a little bit more on the structure piece before we get into some other things. First, I was speaking with a sports performance coach the other day, and he was speaking about how when he does stuff for the NBA pre-draft workout, you know, they'll do different personality tests to determine, you know, to what extent do they rely on creativity, to what extent do they rely on structure, you know, where do they most succeed and why. And, you know, within that, they're able to kind of give feedback to different teams on, like, hey, this is a creative guy, he's going to be happier or more productive in a free flowing offense, you know, and this guy, he's more structured, he needs plays, he needs this, that, and the third. you know, did you guys ever get into any of that type of stuff as far as like assessments to be like, hey, you know, we got a bunch of guys that we're interested in, but let's kind of take a look to see, you know, a little bit more in detail to see if that's something that's going to fit us even more.
You mean from like the recruiting standpoint?
Yeah, from like a personality assessment point of view. Yeah, exactly. As you're looking at players.
You know, I don't think we probably could have done more of it, but it wasn't that. I don't think we had necessarily the tools to be able to, you know that up front.
Okay.
So it was, you know, it was more kind of going off of feel and hearsay through the recruiting process. Right. Like, hey, this is what this guy seems like. You know, talking to, you know, you go watch him play. You know, in AAU, following up with those coaches to be like, hey, you know, it looks like, you know, does he always, you know, kind of take those wild shots? and you know, you kind of you know, you get more clues, so to speak. But I don't think, you know, you try and lean on, that's why, you know, the relationship piece is so huge. You know, you hopefully are dealing with people that, you know, you trust their word, you know, because some people will try and, you know, sell a kid up to you and say, oh, nah, you know, he's great coach. He'll fit in and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But
Right.
So, you know, you try and get as close to that mark as you can, but, you know, it's an inexact science, I think, at the end of the day. And the things that could help you is, you know, calling around as much as you can, developing and having people that you trust and, you know, making decisions with, you know, your gut and, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for at that time. Because, you know, mistakes are bound to be made.
Mm. All right. So going back to, you talked about how the leadership, a lot of it, you know, a lot of the magic happens during those summers where you have, you know, basic training and then different military training pieces. But what's done, if anything, you know, on the court to kind of create, to help improve the leadership, to help improve, you know, learning how to follow, and how kids are held accountable for such things?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably didn't give ourselves enough credit from the basketball standpoint, but, you know, one of the things, and, you know, why West Point was great, they really believe deeply in the value of sports and what that will do for, you know, you as a leader. You know, actually West Point's creed is, you know, every cadet an athlete. So whether you're playing on the varsity basketball team at West Point or, you know, you're just, again, that valedictorian kid from Indiana, you know, everybody at West Point has to pick up a sport. Whether that's a varsity sport or that's a club or intramural type of sport. Because the big thing that, you know, West Point values and sees is, you know, sports allows you to, you know, just learn so much about, you know, the battlefield, honestly. Learning how to operate within the team structure. Again, that group over self, you know, aspect in that mindset. It also, you know, teaches you valuable leadership, you know, experiences that you can't just get in the classroom or, quite frankly, in a military simulation training. You know, you know, you'll learn things and how to adapt and react on the fly in the heat of competition. Those will be directly, you know, relatable to, you know, hey, you know, you name the country overseas and, you know, you're, you know, a lieutenant or, you know, you're the captain or whatever. And you got to lean on those experiences that you had, you know, under stressful, you know, athletic environment. So it directly correlates, you know, but, you know, specifically speaking for Army basketball and, you know, kind of things that we did, you know, there was a little bit too of, all right, these guys, you know, they're getting fed, you know, a lot of structure, you know, as it is. So we would try and as much as we can inject, you know, that, you know, kind of space to be creative and, you know, open and, you know, not make it completely, you know, structured, if that makes sense.
Right.
Not as a way to, you know, kind of detract from what the academy's doing, but more of as a way to, you know, provide. Yeah, exactly. And just give them another outlet to, you know, kind of be an individual as opposed to, you know, just being a cadet. So those are kind of some things we would try and do to, you know, kind of add to their experience and hopefully make them in the process, you know, better players.
So were there ever any, like, leadership programs like within Army, whether that be a classroom or, you know, as a separate like clinic or, you know, those type of things that were presented to the cadets to help them, improve on their leadership abilities?
Yeah, that's actually one of the biggest things that, you know, I took for granted and I miss dearly. West Point is one of those places where people want to be involved at, you know, with West Point. They want to be affiliated with it. You know, the same way you want to, you know, ask as many questions about, you know, West Point, you know, people from mm-hmm. all over want to, you know, come in and experience what West Point is, what it has to offer. And if they feel they could help, they want to do that. You know, we've had the cadets have had the luxury of having, you know, John Gordon, you know, Angela Duckworth, you know, some, you know,
great people in those fields.
Yep. So there's a ton of different things that they'll do to enrich, you know, the cadets' leadership experience outside of just what the academy offers, which I thought was the coolest thing. You know, it would have been easy for West Point to just be like, hey, you know, we're West Point, you know, you're going to be great because of what we do. Like, no, they would branch out and right. they bring, you know, military leaders in, you know, they bring Coach K in, you know, they bring General Brown, you know, it's, you know, military, entertainment, you know, sports. You know, we were lucky when I was there, the Knicks came and did training camp and, you know, Phil Jackson came and spoke to the cadets. You know, that's one of the things that is kind of a hidden benefit, at least for me selfishly being there, was just the exposure to the different levels of speakers and leaders that would come to campus.
That's really interesting. You mentioned a couple of people that are, you know, prominent in their fields respectively. One of them that some people might not know, the listeners, Angela Duckworth. She's a famous researcher on a concept in sports psychology that's known as grit, which is basically your ability to persevere over long periods of time to accomplish your goals. And a lot of her research kind of dips into, you know, what it's not necessarily the smartest person, the fastest person, et cetera, but it's that person who can, you know, face adversity time and time again and just like continue working and continue to get better. And she developed, you know, she talks a lot about growth mindset and, you know, rather than, you know, a fixed mindset, whereas, you know, this is who I am, this is all I can be, where in contrast to that growth mindset of, hey, I can, you know, if I put my mind to it, I can accomplish it. And she talks again about how that type of mindset can be developed. So I could just imagine, you know, the conversations that they have on those campuses and the programs that they put on are.
And correct me if I'm wrong, probably, I think a big part of her study was she studied the basic training at West Point for incoming cadets. So I was pissed off, man. I was out recruiting when she came. So I missed that one, but. She's a giant in that industry, obviously.
Definitely. So were you able to see what you said you saw? You were able to be there when Phil Jackson was there with the Knicks?
Yep.
So what are some of the things that he kind of spoke to, that what knowledge drops did he have there that you kind of took away a few nuggets?
So we got to eat with him as a team. So I wasn't at his table. So I had Courtney Lee, Marshall Plumlee at the time, who's now actually in the Army. So those guys were at my table, Kylo Quinn. So I wasn't lucky enough to speak to Phil Jackson one-on-one, but I'm sure he had some good nuggets for those guys.
So anything that you took from Courtney Lee or Plumlee?
Plumlee
went to Duke, right?
Yeah, he went to Duke. He actually, it was funny kind of hearing him because he, at the time, was, you know, saying if he could do it all over again, he would come to West Point, you know, play Division I basketball and, you know, commission as an officer in the military.
Yeah.
We thought he was, you know, kind of full of it. But here he is now. He's actually an officer in the military. He's went through, you know, Duke's ROTC program to become an officer, and now he's doing it. So he actually was true to that word. But, you know, one of the cooler guys that came down actually was Bob, General Bob Brown. So he was like in charge of the entire Pacific Ocean, and he was one of the first people that Coach K had a chance to coach. And, you know, he had a bunch of hysterical Coach K stories.
Share some. You got to. There's got to be something you can share. I'm sure we could go off the air at some point and talk about other ones.
We definitely got to go off the air on him. But, you know, one of the cool things that he said that Coach K used to always stress to him, and it was kind of, honestly, it was a little cheesy, but it's just so simple. And he's like, listen, Coach K uses this still with every Duke team that he coaches to this day. You know, he uses this with us back at Army. And it kind of ties back into, you know, just that point of, you know, group over individual, you know, that, you know, the academy kind of instills in you. But he, you know, and you got to think of who General Bob Brown is. You could Google him or whatever, but he's a big guy, you know, like 6'4", 6'5". You know, he looks like this ultimate just war machine. But he could have been the nicest guy. But his hands are, like, huge and all, like, his fingers are all jacked up. But he, you know, he used to always say, you know, he stretched out his hand and, you know, held up his five fingers. And, you know, he said Coach K would always say, you know, you see these five fingers right here? You know, if I were to hit you across the face with this, and he's looking at like one of our freshman players, and he's like, if I were to hit you across the face with this, would it hurt as bad as, and then he balls up his fist. He goes, would it hurt as bad as this coming across your face? And and he was like, Coach Gabe used that to say, obviously, you know, it's, you know, five individuals could get done so few what, you know, five guys that are locked can accomplish. And like, that was just his big mantra. And just, you know, he would always talk about the fist and, you know, Bob Brown, that was like his parting remark for our team was, you know, be the fist, don't be the open hand. So, that's always kind of stuck with me, with Coach K.
Coach K has a book as well. It's like the 5 point something. I forgot the name of it, but he goes on and tells like that exact same story. He writes a whole book on it. It's when Shane Battier was there helped, you know, that era of Duke teams. But I don't ever remember him in there talking about, you know, when he'd say stuff to Bob Brown and like, which is going to hurt more.
Yeah, you got to think, too. This is back in the 70s at Army. So you could be a little bit more tough guy approach.
I love it. That's great. That's a great story. We'll talk a little bit more afterwards when we get done here. I'm going to just kind of look over my notes here a little bit more. I'm going to edit some of this segment out. I want to see what else I wanted to get into here. We spoke a little bit about the pillars of the program. We spoke to leadership. And the other one you talk about is servitude. You know, just how was that instilled in people? And how did people learn to take a step away from themselves and learn it's not about them, outside of kind of those summer programs and those military programs, but kind of what was done in practices and within the school that allowed that to happen?
Yeah. It's hard to pinpoint one, you know, specific thing.
Right.
There were just a number of different things. Everything was done through the prism of, you know, a group or a team, you know, structure, you know, so and everything was typically, you know, demanding, whether that was in the classroom, obviously in the military training, or, you know, for us on the court. You know, we were trying to do something at West Point that had never and still has not ever been done, which is, you know, make it to an NCAA tournament. You know, we would always joke around. We would always joke around and be like, listen, it's easier to graduate from West Point than it is to, you know, lead a basketball team to the NCAA tournament, because one's never been done before. Yeah. So there was always, and I would say positive, but there were always positive stressors for cadets, and they were all done within a group lens. So legitimately, everything that you did relied on, you know, stepping away from yourself to get stuff done. You know, whether that was, you know, shooting drills or conditioning drills, or that was, you know, in your company as a cadet, you know, making sure that, you know, your floor or your room was clean, and making sure that not just your side of the room was clean, but, you know, you made sure your roommate's side was clean as well, because you would, you know, bang for
checking,
you know,
double.
So, anything you can imagine was, you know, there was nothing where, you know, individually succeeding would would benefit you. You know what I mean? Like, obviously there was stuff that you got recognized for doing within group settings. And, you know, obviously even on the court, you know, the best five guys are ones that get rewarded. But right. So there's always that expectation of, all right, you know, let me make sure I'm doing the best I possibly can. But overall, you know, you didn't get stuff done there unless, you know, you were concerned about, you know, making sure you were bringing other people with you, or you were making sure that they were pulling their weight. And that's what, you know, I think you just, you know, a lot of places that you go, you only get that at basketball practice and with your basketball team.
Right.
But once you leave that gym, right, or you leave that practice, yeah, you do whatever the hell you want. Yeah. You know, at West Point, you're getting that, you know, 24/7, which I think, again, is another, you know, secret to the sauce at those places.
Yeah. Well, then I like how you brought in the example of, you know, you have your bed checks, you have your room checks. You got to make sure your side is clean and the other person's is clean. You know, that's, you know, those are little things as a sports performance coach or in strength and conditioning stuff that I do on my end, where if I have big groups that are going to be training together and I know they have responsibilities to take care of before we get into our main training session, they have to be able to not just individually understand what program stuff they have to do, what you know, warm up, et cetera, as individuals, but then collectively as a team, because you'd have sometimes when you'd have, you know, 8-10 people show up and instead of the full 15. So when the next group comes in, they got to make sure that, hey, these people know as well. And I think those are qualities that are super important, not just at the collegiate level, but at younger levels as well. You know, I think whatever domain you're in, whether it be, you know, the classroom, strength and conditioning, whether it be, you know, in the sport, actual sport of baseball or basketball or whatever, but if to be able to reinforce those concepts continually and understand, you know, and create that culture of, like you said, servitude and just being able to understand the success of the team is above everything else. You know, sometimes that's overlooked and it has to be reinforced, you know, time and time again to keep that winning culture, that winning mentality.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right. So, before we get going here, what do you have any stories just from your experience at West Point, you know, whether it be in practice or games, you know, things that stick out as, you know, whether it be fond memories, funny stories, et cetera, that you'd want to share?
Oh geez, most of them can't probably be shared over on the record.
That's fair.
But no, it was just so many different things on the court, off the court. I was lucky to be able to coach just great kids. You know what I mean? Like, you know, one of the most heartbreaking things was, you know, feeling like, you know, you had a group that was close to, you know, getting to that NCAA tournament, but and falling up short. You know, those you know, the end of every season always sticks with you, just, you know, reflecting on the relationships that you made, but there are probably just too many good ones. I'm probably not doing it enough justice, but you know, I'll always love my time that I spent there. And you know, now, you know, it's kind of set me up you know, perfectly for, you know, the position that I have now, being a head coach. You know, everything, I'm always kind of leaning back on, you know, things that happened, or, you know, a situation that might have happened along the way that has helped me in some shape or form, you know, to hopefully be a better head coach for my current player. So I have to think about that one and get you some
stories. All right. So how, I mean, as a coach then, I mean, we spoke a lot about the players. How did West Point develop you as a coach, you know, as a leader, and how do you see that playing out as a head coach now at Nichols?
Yeah, no, it's honestly, has been everything. It's taught me, you know, just those basic principles that, you know, West Point just tries to instill. You know, I try and bring a little bit of that, over to Nichols. You know, it's funny, you know, one of the, you know, first things when I had a team meeting, funniest guy on our team, this kid Nadeev, sophomore for us, he was just like, "Man, coach, we heard you're gonna be a drill sergeant. Is that true?" And I was just like, "Oh boy, like the Army reputation might be doing me a disservice." But it was funny. Like, that's, I only said it to say, and the same thing I said in response to Nadeev was, You know, listen, I'm not going to come in there. I wasn't in the Army. I'm not in the Army. I'm not a drill sergeant. That's not what that place is about. You know, it's, if anything, it's more about, you know, creating a family atmosphere and putting that structure in place that allows us to accomplish things at a high level. You know, that's the number one thing. And I told these guys, that was the number one thing that I wanted to bring over from Army. You know, forget all the other stuff. Like, can we, you know, structure ourselves to the point where, you know, we're allowing ourselves the clarity to be creative, to have freedom, to accomplish something at a high level like that. I think that's the biggest thing that I could apply from West Point to Nichols. And then obviously there's smaller things that I might have learned along the way that I could apply to, you know, unique situations. The other thing that, you know, I don't know if this was just a West Point thing or just, you know, in general, just a collection of things I've learned at every stop is, you can't coach and you can't lead, you know, everyone the same way. Like, obviously there's a general path that you want a group to follow. But I think at least the key for me, kind of reflecting on this year and, you know, something that I wanted to be intentional about was, you know, making sure that I was coaching each individual. I think it's easy to get wrapped up into, you know, everyone has to bend to this way. I didn't want to be that guy. I believe, and, you know, it's kind of how I always thought as a player coming up, each individual has something different to bring to the table. Each individual reacts differently to the group. And in order to get the most from everybody, you have to make sure each individual is getting what they want, you know? So I don't know if you know Josh Metcalf at all or read any of his books. But he's
I'll have to look into him.
He's good, man. He wrote a book, Chop Wood, Carry Water, that is a pretty good one that has a lot of just different leadership parables and whatnot. But he came and spoke at West Point. That was actually one of the things that stuck out from his talk was, you know, just it was funny. I don't necessarily completely agree with what he was saying, but the gist of it I kind of do. But he was like, listen, I don't and team building exercises. He goes, I believe in, you know, to make the team and the whole, you know, as good as they can be, you got to make sure each individual is as good as they can be. That'll build the team up. So he was a little extreme on that end, but the general point of, you know, focusing on individuals and making sure that you're not losing sight of what's important to each guy was, something that, I tried to bring to the table at Nichols and, well, hopefully continue.
So how do you determine what's important for each guy? How do you go about figuring that out?
Yeah, that's nothing that's done overnight. You know, that's honestly an accumulation of a bunch of conversations. It was actually, I was in a unique spot coming into Nichols. I was the third coach that they've had in 3 years, it was almost like, that kind of wounded, neglected child syndrome a little bit where they're just like, hard to trust anybody coming in, So, that was actually, going back to kind of interviews and whatnot, that was a question that I got a bunch, interviewing for this job was, how do you plan to gain trust and, things of that nature. And, the players, whether they said it or not, it was always a question of, all right, can we trust whoever this is, And the thing that I said, through the interview process and, what I tried to, live out was, listen, this is a day by day thing. Like, hopefully tomorrow I've developed a better relationship with, each individual that I did than I had the day before. And you just hope to stack up as many of those interactions as possible and not just interactions for the sake of interaction, but as many genuine encounters, like actually, getting to the root of, who each person is, like, what does Eric enjoy? What is he like doing? How does he like to be coached? What were your experiences? All right. And just taking them for what they are, not trying to use that to some type of advantage, but legitimately just, developing that relationship. It's something that is not, everyone wants to kind of hear the quick fix, but it's something that you hopefully, it's almost like a bank account. You hope to deposit a little bit day by day, and by the end of it, you look back, right, and, oh shoot, look what we got here.
Well, And I think, like, you're talking about conversations over time, but it's also having, like you said, those intentional conversations to figure out where you can actually have that direct conversation of, you know, how do you like to be coached? Do you like someone that's going to be down your throat? Do you like someone that's going to kind of pull you to the side? Do you not like being called out as, you know, in the middle of a practice type thing? You know, those type of things, in addition to, what was the other piece that I was noting on here? I'm gonna have to edit this part out because I completely forgot what the next piece was. where is this in my notes? I was taking notes as you were speaking. I was gonna speak to him a little bit. But yeah, I mean, so coaching to each, if when you're talking about coaching to each player individually, what things kind of stick? I mean, obviously I mentioned, you know, as far as like whether they want to be yelled at, not yelled at, whether they want to be pulled to the side, you know, how they want to be coached. What are some differences you are intentional about in creating the different ways in how you coach different players?
Yeah. Honestly, just, it's funny that's one of my favorite questions is, you know, how do you like to be coached? You know, it's one thing that, you know, most players have never been asked that. You know, a lot of times, you know, coming up, it's just, you know, my way or the highway, listen to what we're doing, all right, break. So it's funny how just that simple question, you know, throws guys off. And I'm like, listen, if you don't got an answer for it now, like, just, you know, think about it, come back to me, let me know. Because, you know, just that one simple thing has helped me, I think, as a first-time head coach in tense mm-hmm. situations, you know what I mean, where, you know, I'd be in the middle of the whole group and wanting to blow up on, you know, one of the players, and, you know, in the back of my mind, it's like, wait, that dude doesn't respond well to being singled out or called out. All right. Like, let me address this from a general standpoint with the group, but then I'm gonna grab that guy after and be like, listen, you know, I was, you know, referring to you when I was saying that, right? Like, and just pull him aside.
Okay.
Just something that small with that guy goes a long way to, you know, gaining his trust, you know, because, all right, this was me following through on my word, you know, something that we talked about behind closed doors. All right, he came through on when, you know, when it mattered, you know, and now, you know, chances are he's probably not going to make that same mistake versus, all right, you know, rewind, have that same situation and blow up on Johnny in front of everybody and, you know, tell him how wrong he was and this is how we're doing things here, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
You know, he would have shut down and completely got defensive and also lost trust and said, you know what, this guy's full of it. You know, he said one thing, and, you know, here he is doing the other. So it's a little, you know, I'm simple with my approach to things like that. Like, it's not, you know, that's, you know, a simple thing that I try and really stay true to and dive in on. And, you know, I've got that, or at least I try and get that, and continue to try and develop that with each guy, you know, because I really want to make sure I'm not violating that.
Right. And at that stage, I think a lot of players at that age level, you know, they're pretty, they've played for a while. They're experienced. They have a certain talent level. So they should know by that stage, even if they can't verbalize it, they're able to over time. And I, you know, coaching with a lot of younger players, a lot of times those conversations, they lead around to the parents saying, oh, you can yell at him, or, oh, you can do this, you can do that. He likes to be coached that way. But then when you do that like that, you can see, okay, he's not responding well, he's shutting down. That, you know, it really has to be that individual conversation. And then, you know, and then if they don't know, as you experiment, you're going to be able to see, you know, what are they responding to? You know, what are they, what's picking them up? What's making them more competitive? What's making them more engaged, and vice versa? You know, what's putting them out there where you can tell they don't want to be there.
Exactly. And I think it's something too, like, again, it's that day by day kind of build that I was referring to. Like, there is a little bit too, like, all right, once you start to kind of develop a base for, you know, what makes, you know, Johnny tick, then it's a little bit like, all right, let's let Johnny into the process a little bit too. Like, all right, Johnny, understand that sometimes, you know, I'm not going to be able to, you know, take you to the side. You got to understand that, you know, I might have to yell at you in front of your teammates for everyone to kind of get the point. Are you good with that responsibility? You know, and it's kind of almost, you know, coaching them up to, you know, kind of respond to how you want them to respond, you know, but you can't do that until, you know, you've deposited some level of trust in each other.
Yeah.
So that's right. You know, and it's not always going to be, you know, how that first conversation, what we talked about, like there will have to be some mm-hmm. adjustments. And I think that's where growth comes into it. And that's where, you know, growth is built. So, but it has to start, right. with, you know, developing a certain level of respect and trust to get to those advanced points.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, that's something very similar to what I do as well. Is there's in my perspective as well, you're always trying to create different types of pressures in the training environment and practice environment. And once you establish that trust and you know that, you know, the other person is coming from a good place, you can start to explain, hey, we're going to switch things up a little bit. Yes, can you take that? And then eventually getting them to the point where, you know, you need to be able to respond to this type of tone, this type of pressure that I'm giving onto you, because it's in some ways it's similar to what happens in the competitive environment. And so you have to be able to react to any type of situation. And the more you're able to react in a positive way to those high pressure situations, again, whether it be with a time constraint or with, you know, a coach yelling at you or with, you know, number of shots you have to make in a row, you know, that's what helps kind of get things into the system that where it's mastered and you can just, you know, it becomes automatic.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, couldn't agree more, man.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we're at a little bit past our time and we've had a few hiccups along the way, but overall, you know, this has been great experience and great conversation, B. Thank you for taking the time. Much appreciated. And yeah, we'll have you back on here again sometime, hopefully after you win a national championship.
Hey, that's the plan, man. That'd be great. You know, I appreciate you bringing me on. Do your listeners know that your nickname is Cheese? Is that something I could...
No, they don't. I don't know if your listener or if the listeners know or your any of your kids that you coach. Your nickname.
I'll plug myself here. If you want to hear, you know, Cheese and the origins of the Cheese nickname, find me online. You can email me. I'll be happy to share. But no, man, I appreciate it, man. It was great talking. You know, obviously love what you're doing, and you know, wish you the best moving forward.
Yeah, and can if people do want to reach out to you, do you have any social media or ways they can reach out to you and speak with you if they want to know those stories or otherwise?
Yeah, Twitter, I'm @coach_Linton, and then my email is just firstname.lastname.brandon.linton@nichols.edu.
Awesome, B. All right, Stick. Well, take care. We'll speak again soon here.
All right, man. I appreciate you. Have a good one.